The court will hear arguments first this morning in Bazemore against Friday. Ms. Kuhl, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like to address in my argument this morning three of the issues raised in this case. But first, I would like to articulate briefly our position with respect to each. The first issue concerns the intentionally discriminatory pay disparity between black and white agricultural service agents, which originated pre-Title VII but continued after the effective date of Title VII. Both courts below agreed on the existence of these disparities, but the Court of Appeals held that because the difference in pay originated before Title VII, the current pay practice was not actionable. It is our position that a current practice of intentionally paying blacks less than whites on the basis of race cannot be immunized by the fact that the practice began before Title VII's effective date. The second issue concerns use of statistics in Title VII disparate treatment cases. The issue framed by the private petitioners is whether a statistical analysis must take into account every conceivable non-racial variable before the statistics may be considered probative. We do not believe that a plaintiff's statistical proof must account for every conceivable factor that might bear on salary. Indeed, a statistician would tell us that that is not possible. But we do take the position that the plaintiff here has met the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence in proving discrimination on the statistics presented in this case. In contrast to petitioners, however, we argue that in order to raise an inference of intentional discrimination, it is necessary for the statistical analysis to eliminate the most common non-discriminatory reasons for the disparate treatment, leaving racial discrimination as a logical inference. And we also believe that a plaintiff must offer statistics raising that inference as part of his prima facie case in accordance with the order of proof set forth in McDonnell Douglas. Finally, the third issue concerns disestablishment of the pre-Act segregated system of operating 4-H and Extension Homemaker Clubs. Private petitioners now seem to be arguing that the courts below erred in not addressing whether there was current discrimination in recruitment for membership in the clubs. This is essentially a fact-bound question, and although we believe that recruitment was addressed by the courts below, we would have no objection to a remand on that liability issue. However, in their petition, the private petitioners seem to state a different legal issue, that is, whether as a matter of law, respondents should be held to have failed to disestablish a formerly segregated system when some all-white and some all-black clubs continue to exist. On this legal issue, we believe that the court below was clearly correct. A state that has ensured that all of its practices relating to admissions are truly race neutral need not eliminate an open admission membership system that would otherwise be the norm in order to assure a particular racial mix. To return it then in somewhat more detail to the first issue, the continuing race-based salary disparity, it is important to note that pre-1965, the entire agricultural extension service was operated on a de jure segregated basis. Both the district court and the court of appeals found that agents working in this system were paid different depending on whether they worked in the black branch or in the white branch. Both the district court and the court of appeals also found that this pay disparity was intentionally continued by the service and persisted after 1972 when Title VII became applicable to the states. The error of the court of appeals was in excusing this post-act discrimination on the basis that it originated in the pre-1965 de jure period. But the Court of Appeals analysis, we think, misreads this Court's decisions in Evans and in Hazelwood and misconstrues the nature of the violation proved. The wrong alleged here is not that the service failed to correct the effects of pre-Act discrimination. The wrong here is rather a current post-Act practice of paying blacks less than whites. As was stated in Evans, the question is really whether a present violation exists. An employer is entitled to treat pre-Act discriminatory practices as to which the time has — either pre-act practice or practices to which the time has run as if it was totally legal. Thus, in Evans, the firing of the stewardess was merely considered an unfortunate event in history. But here we have something entirely different from a promotion, a pre-act promotion or hiring decision or firing decision. What we have here is a present violation that of the sort that was lacking in Evans. The violation here rests solely, does not rest solely on pre-act conduct. Rather, there is a purposeful post-act practice of paying blacks less than whites. On the second issue of the statistical proof of discrimination in the agent's salaries, we have shown in our brief that the statistics offered in this case were sufficient to meet the plaintiff's burden of showing purposeful discrimination.
Ms. Kuhl, this case was tried, it was bench tried, was it not?
I believe that's correct.
And did the district court actually exclude statistical evidence, or did it just find it unpersuasive?
The district court allowed in the statistical evidence, but it seriously misunderstood what and misanalyzed what was in the statistical evidence. For example, the district court said there was no statistical evidence with regard to performance of the agents.
Well, this is just a question of whether its finding then was clearly erroneous, I suppose.
I believe that's right, although I think it is a mixed question of fact and law, and we think
Why do you think it's a mixed question of fact and law?
Well, because I think that the appropriate use of statistics is, and whether the burdens have been met, and the allocation of the burdens is really a question of fact. The district, but if it is considered a question of law, our view is that the
Well, why should it be considered a question of law? Why isn't it a question of fact, just as you say?
Well, I think that it is, particularly in this case, where the district court seemed to misunderstand the use of statistical evidence, and the Court of Appeals also seemed to misunderstand the use of statistical evidence.
Well, is there some great legal principle controlling statistical evidence that doesn't control other kinds of evidence? I mean, presumably there's some good statistical evidence, some that's moderately persuasive, and some perhaps it's so bad shouldn't be persuasive at all. Why treat statistics differently than other kinds of evidence?
Well, indeed, that's our submission, that the statistics should be treated the same as the order of proof in a McDonnell Douglas type of situation. We think that the private petitioner's criticism of the test that we suggest, placing a prima facie burden on the plaintiffs to create an inference of intentional discrimination, we think that the private petitioners misperceive what we're really asking here. We're asking no more, and it's no more complicated than what happens in a McDonnell Douglas type of situation where the plaintiff has to show that he met the qualifications of the job, and the defendant may then go back and say, yes, but someone else was more qualified.
To get by the initial showing, you have to accept these statistics.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Justice.
Following up Justice Rehnquist's question, don't you have to say that the district court's view of the statistics was clearly erroneous?
Well, I think
for
that
you
we
to
meet that burden
prevail?
Here. I think that we meet
so
that
is the question.
Here.
Was its finding about the statistics clearly erroneous?
It would still be my view that it's a mixed question of fact and law in this case.
Well, now you've answered the question differently at least twice. Is it a question of fact or not?
I think it's a mixed question of fact and law, but I think we also meet
well,
the clearly erroneous.
Question? What's the legal question in it?
I think the legal question is the appropriate allocation of the burden of proof here. But we've briefed the case also as though it could be considered a question of fact. With respect to the desegregation of the 4-H and Extension Homemaker Clubs, the main point that we wish to make is this. This Court has never held that the traditional free choice of non-state actors must be eliminated before a system can be found to be desegregated. Even in Green versus the School Board in a school desegregation context, the Court explicitly left open the prospect that a free choice plan might sometimes be appropriate. The Court held that the free choice plan in the context of that case was, however, a contrived way of doing business with no legitimate rationale. In contrast here, the normal way of operating these 4-H clubs is by an open membership system. It's further important to understand here that the district court has found no discrimination in services or membership with respect to the clubs as of the time of trial. Indeed, the court expressly found that any racial imbalance existing among the clubs was the product of exclusively and wholly voluntary choice of private individuals, that is, of non-state actors. The private petitioners argue that freedom of choice with respect to club membership has not been the norm in the 4-H system because whites were required to attend white clubs and blacks were required to attend black clubs. But that misperceives how one determines what the norm would have been. In any de jure segregated system, there is assignment on the basis of race during the de jure period. But the issue is what happens with respect to, say, whites among whites and blacks among blacks. Thus, in a situation with respect to, say, parks or seats on a bus or indeed colleges, the norm is a free choice admission program. And in those situations, we believe that disestablishment certainly can be found even though free choice has been preserved. I have nothing further unless the Court has any further questions.
Mr. Snapper.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to address my comments first to the second issue in our petition, the statistical evidence problem. And I'd like to begin by responding to the questions that Justice Rehnquist and Justice White asked of my colleague regarding the nature of the issue before the Court. It is our contention that the issue here is an entirely legal question. The Court of Appeals and the District Court had somewhat different theories, and the legal issues that they raise are therefore distinct. In the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals held that statistical proof was, in its words, unacceptable as evidence of discrimination, and that was as a matter of law, unless, and again I quote, all measurable variables thought to have an effect, end of quote, were included. In other words, in a case where there was evidence, as here, that blacks and whites in the same job were getting different salaries, and further evidence that that couldn't be explained by differences in experience or education or job performance, in the Court of Appeals' view, as a matter of law, that evidence was simply insignificant, and a district court could not have made a finding of discrimination on it even if it had wanted to. On the contrary, on the Court of Appeals' view, this case should have been dismissed, I think, under
be drawn from the facts.
As I read the Court of Appeals' opinion, unless all measurable variables are included.
Nevertheless, it's a question of what conclusion may be drawn from the facts that were before the Court.
But a rule of law that a certain inference is impermissible is a rule of law, even though it concerns the drawing of inferences, just like the order of proof set forth in McDonnell Douglas is a rule of law. The district court had a somewhat different theory. The district court at page 133, in its opinion, made a finding that the plaintiffs had established a prima facie case. Our disagreement with the district court, and I think indeed a disagreement in between the district court's opinion and those of this court, concerns how to rebut a prima facie case of discrimination. On the district court's view, a defendant can rebut proof of salary discrimination merely by offering evidence that additional factors go into its salary determinations, which were not included in its analysis. The district court clearly held, and I think this is inconsistent with this Court's previous decisions, that a defendant is under no obligation to deduce any evidence that those factors in any way correlated with race.
Mr. Schneffer, why isn't this case really more to be judged in the light of Aikens versus Postal Service rather than McDonnell Douglas, since all the proof was in? The district court is simply making findings as to whether the plaintiffs had carried their ultimate burden of proof of showing discrimination.
Well, it's our position that the district court's view as to what a plaintiff had to do was wrong as a matter of law. The district court's view was that a plaintiff was required to do more than show that there were differences in the average salaries of blacks and whites, even when you control for education and a number of other factors. The district court's view was that we had to control for everything, and even for a number of issues which the district court frankly said it was impossible to control for. Now, if that's the standard, it simply would be impossible to use statistical evidence under any circumstances. This isn't a case where the district court, in which the district court said, look, given how much you did do and given the evidence on the other side, on balance, I'm persuaded that there was no discrimination. This is a case in which the district court said simply, the fact that the defendants can think up something else that you might have done in your statistics, even though there's no claim that it would have changed the result, is dispositive.
Well, his finding on that score may have been clearly erroneous. Perhaps the evidence is so clear that although there may be some evidence to support that an appellate court is convinced a mistake has been made. But I don't see why that turns the whole question of use of statistics into inevitably a question of law.
Well, the burden set out in McDonnell Douglas when a defendant comes forward and tries to rebut statistical evidence is that it has to offer evidence which if believed would constitute a non-racial explanation. Now that requires, as I read McDonnell Douglas, two things.
Let me ask you again, Mr. Schnapper. Since all of this material did go to the finder of fact and he ultimately resolved the case, I think McDonnell Douglas deals with what you do to get through finally to having the finder of fact decide it. Once you get to the finder of fact, it's simply a question of who's carried the ultimate burden of persuasion, isn't it?
Well, we don't think that what the defendant did in this case met the minimal standards that McDonnell Douglas sets.
But the ultimate issue is whether or not there was discrimination, isn't there?
That's correct, Mr. Justice Rehnquist.
Well,
but it is our contention that there is some minimal amount of evidence that has to be reduced to rebut a prima facie case, and that the minimum simply wasn't met here.
Well, but you're not talking about prima facie cases anymore when you go to the finder of fact and the finder of fact makes a determination. You're talking about did the plaintiff carry the burden of proof to prove this issue? Now, maybe the district court was wrong, but that's simply a question of being clearly erroneous.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I don't think one can read this record as one in which the district court saw evidence on the other side and then weighed it and made a judgment on the merits. This is a case in which the district court believed that the plaintiff's burden was to eliminate every possible non-racial explanation and that if it didn't meet that burden, the plaintiff should lose. I mean, the decision ought to have been a factual one, but that is simply not what happened here. The district court required us to do something which McDonnell Douglas and all the cases decisions in this court say we're not obligated to do. And I recognize that in your concurring opinion, as I recall, in Dothard versus Rawlinson, you indicated a particular willingness to refer to a district court's views with regard to the weight of statistical evidence, and there certainly would be cases in which that was appropriate. But this is not that kind of a case. This isn't a situation in which there was conflicting statistical evidence and the district court ruled in favor of the defendants. This is a case in which all the statistical evidence was one side, and the district court said, well, yes, but it could have been better. It was very good, but it wasn't perfect, and if it isn't perfect, you lose. And it seems to me that the court has repeatedly held that you don't have to do that as a matter of law.
Well, did the court, in effect, grant a directed verdict for the defendant? Is that your position? That what the court did was simply, in effect, give a directed verdict or a summary judgment?
I think it was close to that at some point. I mean, the case did go to the end of trial. It didn't stop in the middle. But this is not a situation in which there was a balancing of the evidence. The district court simply said that the kind of evidence that the plaintiff had introduced simply was insufficient to meet its burden under any circumstances because it had, for example, because the plaintiff had failed to include
its evidence. Well, if they said it was insufficient, it sounds like a weight of the evidence problem. That's what makes it so hard to understand.
Well, Justice Conner, the district court held that statistical evidence which fails to include unmeasurable variables is insufficient as a matter of law to prove discrimination. Now, it is impossible to include unmeasurable variables. The district court clearly required us to do something which it acknowledged was impossible to do. Now, I don't know that that can be reasonably characterized as going to the weight of the evidence. It simply set a standard that was unmeetable. I think the manner in which this issue arose throws considerable light on its on the nature of the question. Initially, the plaintiffs made clear that they had evidence that the average salaries of blacks and whites in the same job were different. The defendant undertook to meet what we all understood to be the defendant's burden, that is, to come forward with evidence which tended to show that some legitimate non-racial factor could have explained it. And they retained a statistician, and they said, look, we think there are three factors which would explain why blacks earn less than whites. We think it's job experience, we think it's education, and we think it's sex. And they said, go recalculate the numbers. We believe it's going to show that when you take those three things into account, there is no disparity. Well, the statistician did exactly the calculation that I think Dothard and Hazelwood and all of this Court's cases require, came back and said, you're wrong. The evidence, in fact, is that when you look at these factors, it doesn't eliminate the disparity. Indeed, in some cases, it increases the disparity. At that juncture, the defendants, rather than attempting once again to offer evidence of a factor that might have explained away the discrimination, the differences in salaries, the defendants took a completely different attack. They said, well, we can think of nine other factors that might have explained this, but we aren't going to show you any evidence that, in fact, it did explain it. We are, for example, to focus on the issue of particular importance in the Court of Appeals, but also emphasized in the district court. The defendants argued, it's possible that the reason blacks earn less than whites is because blacks are concentrated in the poor-paying counties in the state. And the district court said, well, since that's a possibility, the plaintiffs are going to lose. The defendants never introduced any evidence that blacks were, in fact, concentrated in the poor counties in the state. Indeed, the evidence is quite clearly to the contrary. But it was the district court's view and the Court of Appeals' view that the fact that some other factor which never had been dealt with, hadn't been dealt with, was dispositive in and of itself, without regard to there being any evidence or any claim that that factor had an explanatory power. To take a simpler example closer to the original facts in McDonnell Douglas against Green, imagine a case in which a plaintiff introduced evidence, according to McDonnell Douglas, that she had applied for a job as a teacher, that she was qualified, that she'd been turned down, and that the defendants had then gone on to fill the job with a man. That would clearly meet the plaintiff's initial burden under McDonnell Douglas. What the defendants did in this case was to offer a defense limited to the following evidence. We prefer people who specialize in romance languages. But no evidence that the plaintiff individual didn't, in fact, herself specialize in romance languages. As we understand McDonnell Douglas, the minimal amount of evidence required to rebut a prima facie case is not only that there is a racially neutral policy, but that the racially neutral policy had explanatory power, that it indeed could have accounted for the disparities. That's precisely what the defendants very deliberately did not attempt to show here. And at least in none of these instances, the reason they didn't attempt to show it is clear, because the evidence was quite the contrary.
I take it you and the Solicitor General do not agree on what factors have to be brought in by a plaintiff to meet the statistical evidence burden that you say exists.
There is a difference between our views and that of a solicitor. It is an important one, although in a sense a narrow one. We are of the view suggested by Mr. Justice Rehnquist in his question and in Aikens itself that the court ought to shy away from setting rigid mechanical standards as to just what ought to be in a prima facie case. The government has offered a fairly elaborate 7-part standard that has to be met by statistics in a discrimination case. Their standard hinges on the distinction between major variables and additional variables. And depending on whether a variable is major or additional, the plaintiff or the defendant has to adduce the relevant evidence, and cases will be won or lost depending on how a court classifies a variable. We think that the teaching of Aikens is that the court should not use that sort of approach. We think the various factors identified by the government ought to be considered by a lower court or by this court in weighing evidence of statistics, but that the court should not try to formulate a mechanical standard as to just precisely what has to be in a plaintiff's prima facie case. We don't think that the government standard is it's particularly workable. I don't understand the difference between a major variable and an additional variable. It's clear that on the government's theory, whether we win or lose this case depends on whether certain variables not in the analysis were major or additional. Differences in skill, for example, the government, I think, if I understand the view correctly, regards that as merely an additional variable, not a major variable. It is not included in the statistical analysis. The argument for the state is that, in the government's terms, that's a major variable. The government's brief doesn't explain how one distinguishes the two types of variables, and we would urge the court not to adopt that kind of distinction. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Mr. Manning.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This morning I feel like I'm watching my own autopsy, because as a lawyer who tried the case, working 14 hours a day, day and night, weekends, and being in that courtroom, I'm not hearing the same case that we tried in 1981 and 1982. All we're hearing are legal theories that are not related to the facts that the trial judge, Frank Dupree, found after hearing all of the evidence. There's one thing about this case, members of the court, that we have hammered all the way through, and it's the truth and it's the fact. North Carolina is a state of 100 counties. The Extension Service has a branch in each one of those counties. That's indisputed, it's uncontroverted, and it's in evidence. The facts in this case dealing with salary, which the petitioners and the government are so interested in, go to the salaries of individual agents in each county. The biggest fallacy that you will hear and read in their briefs and hear in rebuttal is that it's the same job. It is not the same job. It is not a similar job situation. The record shows, and take for example, the record will show that an agent in the mountains of North Carolina, where there is no golden leaf tobacco, where they are poor people, where they scratch a living out in the soil, where the county tax base is poor, the evidence shows that that agent who goes out and teaches the farmers, because that's what an extension agent does. They're teachers, but they teach to an unstructured group. When they go out and teach to the farmers in that county, those people are hired because they are trained and educated in truck farming or apple growing or something else. That, when you go to North Carolina's tobacco belt, in the big counties down there, they want agents that are trained in tobacco. They want them that are trained in soybeans. When you go to Charlotte, in those areas of the state, Union County, where Mr. Bazemore is from, where they have a livestock, they want an agent like Mr. Bazemore, who is trained and knew about pig farming and knew about animal husbandry. It is this type of employment that we're talking about requires special qualifications. It's not blue-collar work. They are college-educated, and most of them have master's degrees. And each one of them are hired in their particular county based upon the needs of that particular county and their educational background. It's just like hiring a tax specialist to come to work in a law firm or a litigation specialist. It depends on what the needs of each of the 100 counties are. Now, we're not going one other thing I would say, that's the facts. If you look at the facts, you will see that the jobs are not similar. And once you understand that principle, their arguments are bouncing off the beautiful walls in here, because Judge Dupree, and we knew it, and we told them that those are what the facts are, and they just have disregarded it. They disregarded it this morning in their argument. They disregarded it in their briefs, because we're not dealing with similar jobs. The way their statistical case and their case fell apart is that they didn't take this into account. They came in, and Judge Dupree let in all the evidence. He didn't keep anything out. all the statistical regressions, all of these averages that everybody put in comparing black and white, all of this came in, but they didn't take into account that you can't compare the agent in Ashe County, North Carolina, a poor county in North Carolina who's doing apples and who's teaching people in Appalachia how to truck farm more effectively. You can't compare his job or the economic conditions in which he is paid with that of the chief tobacco agent in Wilson County, North Carolina, where the tobacco crop brings in millions of dollars a year.
Mr. Manning, I thought from reading the Court of Appeals opinion and the district court that these salary disparities, the court said, could have originated from one of two sources.
Quartile.
Intentional disparities before 1965.
That's what the Court of Appeals said.
Yeah.
The Court of Appeals went on.
Now let me just ask you. Suppose the Court of Appeals said that it was just irrelevant if these disparities were just continuations of intentional discrimination that occurred before 1965. That's what it said, isn't it?
The Court of Appeals said that they could not, that was not a present violation.
And do you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Or do you agree with the, do you think that, or the United States says that if after 1965 the disparities were just continued, where they just went right on as disparities, they originated before the Act, but they were continued afterwards. They say that that is current intentional discrimination. Do you agree with that?
In theory, Justice White, we would have to agree with that.
The Court of Appeals didn't agree with that.
No, they did not agree with that.
And it seems to me they seem to say that these disparities might in part be attributable to that, but even if it was, that's just too bad.
Well, let me address the facts
All right.
in answer to your question, because I'm glad you asked it. The Court of Appeals decision, let's go back to the district court.
All right.
I prepared and re-prepared in our brief, taking just the point that you mentioned. The question goes back to the facts. They said, and this is a good time for me to discuss what the salaries are composed of, because this answer will answer a lot of questions if you think about it. The salaries of any agent come from four sources. The first is state and federal funding. The second is the county salary portion, which makes the whole. The only way that a salary, then there is a merit salary increase, whether it comes from the state or federal on odd years or whenever it comes, or the county merit increase. Those are the four sources of funding from the time you start. Each one of those was found by the district court and, again, by the Fourth Circuit. Those sources to be either uniformly applied, no discrimination at all, never has been any in its application, and the performance system, which determined the merit pay, was found to be non-discriminatory. Now I'm going back, all right, to pre-65. We prepared this chart. If what the petitioners say is true, i.e., that we were paying all of the blacks less money before 1965 deliberately, which we contend was not the case, there were average differences between black and white salaries. If that were the case, you would not have the result 7 years later that is shown here. That is just not what the evidence showed. And Judge Dupree saw that evidence.
Did the judge find that there had never had been any intentional discrimination?
Did he say
that there was before 65?
He found that before 65 there was a de jure, a segregated system.
And do you agree with that?
That's the way it was. Yes, sir.
Well.
But after that.
All right, the day after the act became effective, in 1965. There, and these disparities continued, there was still intentional discrimination, right?
I disagree.
Well,
because you, what
you're saying, before the act, there was intentional discrimination, and the day after, there wasn't?
Well, I disagree. The salaries, you have to, you're getting back and taking me away from the fact that these people, whether they were there before 65 or after 65, were doing, not doing the same jobs. In other words, when they came into effect in 1965, they were not, the service knew there were disparities and worked at doing that. But everybody had disparities. If you look at
it sounds to me like you're making an argument that there never was intentional discrimination.
No, I'm not making that argument that there wasn't, because before 65 it was a two-way system.
Right.
Yes,
sir.
Thank you. But the next point that I will make in connection with that and in answer to that as to whether that continued in salaries or not is to look at the chart which we attached as to the appendix to our brief. If that theory was true and it continued, and we say it did not, then there would be a market, and this is Appendix Exhibit A, there would be the pre-65 blacks and the pre-65 whites would be spread like this. If you'll take a look at that chart, which is everybody who was there in 1965 and there in 72, you will find all over the board, from the bottom to the top, whites and blacks interspersed. There were 42 black agents who were there, and there were 65 white agents who were there. And if you will take a look at it, you will see. The point I'm making is that from 1965, when the law took effect, the Extension Service and both courts so found operated on a non-discriminatory basis. And that's what Judge Dupree found as a matter of fact. He did not find a prima facie case on the evidence that came in. Judge Dupree said that a careful weighing and assessment of the plaintiff's statistical and non-statistical evidence led the court to conclude that the plaintiffs had probably made out a prima facie case with respect to defendants' promotion and salary practice, and the analysis of the court proceeded on this assumption. While not conceding that the plaintiffs had made a prima facie case, the defendant Extension Service assumed the burden, which we did, of articulating plausible reasons for its action and its evidence, which the trial court found convincing, has been set forth therein. The plaintiffs failed to produce evidence that our reasons, the defense reasons, were pretextual, and their case failed.
Did the Court of Appeals accept this finding of the district court? If it did, why did it go on to say that it was permissible as a post-act consequence of a pre-act situation?
I didn't write the opinion. I wouldn't have written it that way. I don't know why they said it, but I can give you my best explanation. They were doing the same analysis on where the money comes from. If you read that portion of their opinion, what they were saying was this. There can be no discrimination in across-the-board wages that the state gives. There was none. There was none in the county across-the-board wages, which is the way most employees in government service get paid. There was the only two places that there could have possibly been any discrimination in what they were saying in 1972 was if there was a lingering effect, i.e., what Justice White had said, a lingering effect of what was there of salaries of pre-65 hires who were there in 72. And then they said the other one is the performance or the merit pay system, which is the quartiling system, which we use because our employees don't do the same jobs. They said it in that context. They then said that they did not feel that under Evans or under Hazelwood, that under those conditions that those, if there were lingering effects, that they were presently actionable. I personally would agree with that assessment. I don't know how the court is going to agree with it. I would say 7 years later but that's the context in which they discussed it, which leads into our point that we've tried to make and Judge Dupree saw. The manner in which our agents are paid comes from a system which, and not appeal and not before this court, which is found to be in all facets, in hiring, in promotion, in in-house education, to be non-discriminatory. The Extension Service members of the court, if you read in this entire opinion, and what they didn't appeal from was found to be non-discriminatory completely in its employment practices. And when you look at going to the variable question that Mr. Snapper was talking about a minute ago, that these were imaginary things that Judge Dupree rejected, what I have just told you is hardly imaginary. It's in evidence, and it's the fact. Those were not included in their statistical case, nor did they ever take them into account. The other thing that I think would show the court immediately that what we're saying about our service is it is not uniform from county to county is the county extension chairman salaries, all of whom are the head person in the county, and that's found in the joint appendix on page 165 for 3 years. The range in salaries of the top person in that county is between $2,000 and $5,000 a year. And everybody under him or her is not going to be paid any more, regardless of what kind of job they do or regardless of their specialty. And this is the point. North Carolina's situation is not a factory setting like a widget factory, nor is it examining tax forms. The other thing that is different, that is a major factor that Judge Dupree pointed out in bouncing the regression and not swallowing all of these comparisons that everybody put forth to him, were that the county salaries percentage of state and county vary with each county. For example, if Justice White and I started out at the same time out of law school or out of ag school with the same degree, and we both got a salary of $10,000 a year to start, and he went to a county that had a 70% county state supplement of his salary, and mine was 40. And that's examples in our brief. At the end of the first year, if he got a 5% state raise, he would have gotten a $350 raise. I would have gotten a $200 raise. And that happens every year in 100 counties and affects all employees. It has nothing to do with race. That's what Judge Dupree and the trial court saw. Now, moving to the question, which is one of the issues raised this morning, is that the county extension chairmanships, and this goes for the head person in the county, and I just briefly would say, because it hasn't been argued, but I want to make the point that both courts were correct there. There were 23 individual cases on that issue, 5 futility applicants and 18 actual black plaintiffs who were present in court, whose cases were put on very ably by Mr. Reedman, who's here this morning, put on very ably, and we answered every charge, and Judge Dupree in his opinion on the individual claims found that we had offered a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for each and every single case. That's a factual case. He decided it on the facts. It was not found to be erroneous by the Court of Appeals. And these arguments about general telephone and these other cases, they shouldn't be here, because that case was decided on the facts, and nobody has said that Judge Dupree was clearly erroneous. With respect to the club issue, that is one, members of the court, that is astounding to hear what I've heard this morning. The Extension Service, as Justice White pointed out, was in fact segregated prior to 1965. At the end of 1965, and when it came into effect, they set about to integrate that service and its programs. The 4-H clubs and the Homemaker Extension clubs are viable, educational, voluntary groups run by volunteers and assisted by extension workers in every single county. Mr. Snapper's brief and asserts that there was intentional discrimination in recruitment. And the government pointed out in their brief, there's no evidence of that. We tried this case for 10 weeks. If you look at the fact that the extension programs like this are not static and the membership changes all the time, we've run through 100,000 kids a year and volunteers in that program since 1965. Among those 40,000, or whatever the numbers show, are black. Black male and female volunteers that come to those clubs, who organize those clubs, and black children and white children. And if you look at our figures, we integrated it. The one thing that that the plaintiffs never brought forward out of the hundreds of thousands of participants in North Carolina, male, female, and those who were children in 65 who are adults now, was that there was any evidence that they were ever rejected from membership in a club, that they ever felt the least bit of discrimination in engaging in the programs.
Mr. Manning, since 1965, have there been any all-race or single-race clubs formed in racially mixed communities? Does the record show that?
The record does show that.
And your comment on that is?
My comment on that is that they are formed in racially mixed communities of one race in North Carolina. They are static and they are reborn and they are formed that way. They're formed that way in the other states in the country, and the record shows that. The point that I would make to Your Honor is this. Those people who are organizing those clubs, the black volunteers or the white volunteers, do not deny membership, nor do they discriminate in membership, or do they exclude anyone. Anyone is available to join. And I think Your Honor,
do they encourage the joinder of persons of the opposite race, the other race?
Yes.
Any other race?
That's what the policy of the Extension Service is. That's what the volunteers who are trained by the Extension Service are told to do.
With no effect?
Well, there is an effect. The effect is, if you can see by the, by, and I'll turn to the page, these of 19, to the exhibits on pages, Joint Appendix 173, and on page 174, the effect of this is, and I think I need to point this out, the community clubs that the plaintiffs, the petitioners are complaining about make up the smallest segment of the 4-H program. Above that, if you'll take a look at the record in this case, in membership, you will point out that black membership and white membership in all of the clubs, including those, has grown.
I missed those last words.
Has grown. Has gotten, instead of, if in other words, I'm arguing negative evidence. There's no evidence at all that anyone was excluded. And yet the program, the positive evidence is that this program has continued to grow in enrollment in black and white volunteers. The camps are integrated.
Yes, ma'am. Show us how many of the clubs have mixed races in them and how many do not.
Yes.
And where is that?
Page 178.
178?
Of the Joint Appendix. There are several exhibits.
Well, 178 tells us the number of single racial clubs in mixed communities. Does it tell us the number of mixed racial clubs in mixed communities, or are there any?
There are, and I cannot, in the Joint Appendix.
This is what I've been trying to get you. This is what I've been trying to get you to say for the last 5 minutes.
Yes, sir. There are and have been a growth, and it's in the record, and I cannot put my hand on that, on the Joint Appendix, but there are mixed-race clubs, both racial clubs, in mixed communities, and I do not have
And it's in the Joint Appendix someplace?
It's in the Joint Appendix at page 134. Right here. On page 134. It gives the enrollments at least 377. Showing the number of 4-H units integrated in mixed communities. And that is the second column down.
Mm-hmm.
I would point out.
So as of, if I'm reading it correctly, as of 1977, 56% of the 4-H units in mixed communities were, in fact, integrated?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And it has gone up to 39%.
Yes. I would point out this additional point that above, the focus has been microcosmed by the petitioners in this case on just this. Above, the community clubs are a small segment. In addition to the community clubs are what are known as special interest groups, which are formed, for example, to do model airplanes or to do something. And these are integrated in this. But what I would say is there's just no evidence. They put on no evidence, and there is no evidence that anybody came forward and said, we feel that we've been discriminated against. We didn't join because we didn't want to. There's no evidence of that at all.
Was evidence put in about an effort being made on the part of the Extension Service to attract integrated units?
The effort, there is a lot of evidence that's put in on that issue, and it's hotly, that was, to be frank with you, it was a hotly how we accomplished it. And what the plaintiffs wanted us to do was the thrust of this. There was a guideline called All Reasonable Efforts, and I won't duck this one, which was not a, it was not a regulation, but it was a printed guideline which they wanted to go out and say you had to knock on every door in every neighborhood to recruit individuals. The service did not do that. The service encouraged it, and I think it's the growth in the program and the absence of anybody coming forward and saying they were in any way felt discriminated against, didn't join for any reason. We feel that we did all reasonable efforts short of doing that, which was a
Mr. Manning, what is the relationship between the state of North Carolina and the 4-H clubs?
Justice Powell, the relationship is that the 4-H clubs are voluntary organizations that have an extension service agent who is a 4-H agent who would furnish them materials, who will train their volunteer leaders, who will give them pamphlets and programs into how to do something, and then the volunteer and the boys and girls in the program will take the ball and run with it.
Does the state finance them in any way?
The state finances the 4-H agents.
Yes, but in any other way?
But it's my understanding they don't finance the clubs other than they would get materials. The most of the funds come from volunteer time and volunteer contributions, although obviously your pamphlets on how to grow corn or do this model would
Are people free to organize clubs themselves?
Yes, they are.
And most of them organized without inspiration or leadership or direction from the state?
They're organized by volunteers who want to help the children and who are trained by the Extension Service workers in how to effectuate the program.
Aren't the Extension workers required to supervise them, to organize them, and do everything they can to help them?
No, sir. And the reason...
are they there for?
Well, they're not enough extension workers. Well, my answer to the question is this way, Justice Marshall. They're not enough extension workers to deal with 40,000 children.
The number that they have, don't they spend full time on the 4-H clubs?
Those that are in a county which is big enough to afford a full-time 4-H agent. In many counties, the person has 4-H responsibilities who also has corn or soybeans or something else. In other words, it's not a full-time position unless the county has enough money to afford that particular type of agent. And they go out and they will assist the volunteers in organizing, but not go out and organize them themselves. No, sir, they don't have the resources to do that. They're not enough of them.
How many counties have the full-time? Approximately.
I would say now the big ones, probably at least 30 of the 100 counties would have the full time. And I'm not speaking from any real knowledge, just from knowledge of the case.
Are you saying it's not a state function?
It is not. The 4-H program is under the auspices of the Extension Service, but it is not. It is a voluntary program which is not regulated.
Like the white primary?
It has not like the white primary at all.
Is any child or young person compelled to go to these programs?
No.
All voluntary?
All volunteer.
Are there any other teachers except the agents provided by the state?
No, the agent is provided by the state, and he trains the volunteers or would come in and give a program to the club, but he doesn't run the clubs.
But there's no compulsion to join or belong?
There's no compulsion to join at all.
And if you join, you can leave the next day?
You could leave the next day. And these clubs are not fixed in stone. That's all the time I have.
Further, Mr. Snupper. You have 2 minutes remaining.
We're in pretty much agreement with the government that there really aren't factual findings with regard to the 4-H club issue. I'd like to just briefly respond to some factual questions the court raised about this. First, with regard to the size of the state involvement in the clubs, there was testimony at page 4956 of the transcript that the equivalent of 122 full-time state employees worked on 4-H and Extension Homemaker matters. Secondly, at page 5069, there is testimony that the budget for these activities totals approximately $5 million a year. With regard to efforts to assure that new 4-H club and Extension Homemaker clubs are integrated, Mr. Manning said that there was indeed such an effort. I believe that's incorrect. If you look at page 1823 of the Court of Appeals transcript, you'll see an express proposal to require that when someone comes in with a new club in an integrated community and the club is all black or all white, that the organizer be directed to go out and try to recruit members of the other race. If you look at page 1827, you will note it says, deleted from the 1974 Civil Rights Initiatives. That proposal was deliberately and expressly rejected by the service, and they have expressly decided not to do exactly what the court asked if they were doing. There is indeed, as I think Mr. Justice Blackmun inquired, have been an increase in the number of single race club and mixed communities. If you look at pages 103 and 134 of the Joint Appendix, you will see that the total number of single race clubs in integrated communities has indeed gone up from year to year since 1965. We agree with the government that the recruiting...
May I just interrupt there, but hasn't the percentage gone the other way?
The percentage, well, with regard to 4-H clubs, the percentage has gone down only because the number of integrated clubs has gone up. The number of segregated
clubs have gone up.
That's right. But the number of single race clubs has not changed. Well, it's gone down 2% in 8 years. It was, I think, 890, and it's now 880.
But the trend, even though it was very modest, the trend was in the other direction, at least on a percentage basis.
Well, that's right. I mean, we agree on what the facts are. With regard to the Extension Homework Clubs, there has been no such trend, well, to speak of. The latest data is that 98% of all the Extension Homeworker Clubs in the state are either all black or all white. There's something less than 200 blacks in the entire state that belong to a club that has a white member in it. Now, I suppose technically that's progress. They've made 2% in a number of years, and at that rate, I suppose in a very, very long period of time, there might be substantial progress. But I don't think that's the kind of progress that Mr. Justice Stevens had in mind when he asked the question.
You say there are only 200 blacks in integrated clubs in the whole state?
In the Extension Homemaker Clubs, the data is at page 103, it says there are only 22 integrated clubs of about 1,800. Later in the record at 107, it says the number of non-white members of integrated clubs is on the right-hand column about the middle of the page is 197. Yeah. As I said, the government has suggested that we need to have a remand with regard to the recruiting problem because the lower court simply failed to address it. The lower courts accepted the view that Mr. Manning has put forth today that the only obligation that the state had in this area was to assure that if a black actually found his way or her way to a club and applied, that he or she was not rejected. Because of that, the Court of Appeals and lower courts simply thought there was no reason to decide whether there was discrimination in recruiting or to decide whether there were, in fact, continuing effects that dated from the original de jure system, and there simply aren't findings on either of those issues. We would ask the Court to sustain our views that there is such an obligation, that discrimination in recruiting is illegal, and remand the case for appropriate relief.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in United States.